You could spend the weekend doing the same old whatever, or you could conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Welcome to the Wheelhouse.
You can see the confidence build day by day, and there is an electricity to his personality on the field that's really hard to look away from.
Starring Jerry DePoto.
And Jerry DePoto to the plate with the 2-2 pitch to Alex. Swing and a miss. He struck him out on the fastball.
With Aaron Goldsmith.
And now chapter three is, yeah, he's a real ball player. He's an impactful player. He can do a ton for your team, and this is a guy that can really help to solidify a big league lineup.
And Gary Hill Jr.
He seems along those lines where he wants to be great and does everything possible to go get it.
It's time for the Wheelhouse. Here's Aaron.
We are back with the Wheelhouse podcast. Aaron Goldsmith, Gary Hill, and Jerry DePoto recording this in advance of the Atlanta Braves series at T-Mobile Park. Jerry, your ball club has won four straight series, and I just can't put my finger on why.
I think it's because we pitch okay.
I don't know, Jer. I don't know.
I'm going to flip a coin on this.
Yeah, we're going to get – Gary, pull Fangraphs up there. Let's see what's been going on. It has been amazing, Jerry. I mean, Gary and I talk about this relentlessly, how we can't take this for granted. Like, what Mariners fans watch on a nightly basis in the rotation and out of the bullpen is not normal. It's not like this in other places, but what we have seen over the last, call it, 2 weeks and change is in a whole other stratosphere. What's it been like for you?
Just that. It's been like watching from, you know, watching something that's happening on a different planet, because that's how rare it is. I think I don't know the specifics of this, but I think this is the longest stretch of starts like we've seen, with, you know, 4+ innings or 4+ strikeouts for, you know, 2+ weeks through the rotation, that since they invented the earned run or qualified the earned run. And I don't know exactly how it's been framed. I know there was a quirky, you know, they had to adapt it to fit Bryce Miller's short start in Texas. But otherwise, it has been just a flood of not just quality starts, but starts where the opponent just can't get up off the mat. We're filling up the strike zone. We're working fast. You know, I said yesterday jokingly, right before the first pitch of the game, you know, the Sunday day game, I said, Mariners game on a Sunday. You got a chance to come to a 1 o'clock game and get home in time for lunch. You know, it's going fast, and you feel like you're in the 60s watching this, and it's the Koufax, Drysdale, Bob Gibson era of baseball.
Is it the Kirby hair part? Is that what is making you think of
it? It kind of gives you that Beatles vibe. It's great.
You've essentially, with the rotation specifically, you're essentially running an earned run per start, right?
Which is crazy.
Yeah, past 2+ weeks, which is wild. I've never seen anything like this.
And I think it's not just the run suppression, it's the strikeouts, the lack of walks. There's really been no base runners. And, you know, think about it in the last couple of weeks. And eventually, you know, like Goldie was saying, you know, this won't go on forever. Right now, we've got five awesome starting pitchers who are in a real groove. And we have faced real teams. But you're watching, there's no traffic. You never think, oh, man, I hope we can get out of this. and then you're thinking, get out of what? You know, there's a runner on second base with two outs. It's been phenomenal to watch. It's the script as we've laid it out through the years, which is work fast, get ahead, use your best pitches, and fill up the strike zone. They're really doing it to as well as you could do it.
To your point, too, that's the thing that really has stuck out at me in this stretch, because I think the last 16 starts, I think there's been 11 solo home runs in that stretch. To your point, the only way the starters are getting scored on, solo home runs, that has essentially been it, which is amazing. The strand rate is off the charts when there is base runners, but there's often not. It's a culmination of the walk rate is low, the strikeout rate is high, everything's great.
You know, if you go in, and we've talked before in the dominate the zone discussions, you know, how much we value that strikeout walk or the walk strikeout ratios for the hitters and the pitchers. You go in and you look at what our pitchers are doing right now in terms of missing bats, punching them out, and not walking them. It's a different level that they're operating on, and we feel like we're not even really fully clicking yet. You know, we don't have all of our personnel. It's 1 through 13 on our staff. We've had great fortune so far in what we've been able to cultivate with some of the guys in the bullpen that we knew a little less about maybe than some others, and up and down the staff, it's just been awesome night after night.
I keep track of balls and strikes in my scorebook, as I call a game. And the Kirby start, where he struck out at career high 12. At one point in the back half of his start, I was looking through some of the last hitters he had faced, and I noticed that there weren't many balls thrown. And so I keep going back, and I keep going back, hit one hitter and next hitter. And I say to Mike on the air, I said, hey, this is unofficial, right? Like I could have missed a pitch here or there. But I said, in the last like three innings or two-plus innings, I see that he's only thrown four balls, which, I mean, even by a Kirby standard, it's still kind of like, maybe I missed a few. Like maybe we were reading a graphic or I was lost in a conversation. And so I pressed talk back during the break to our producer, and I said, Curtis, is there any way you guys have like batter by batter data? Like starting with, it actually was a nine batter sequence. It was like one time through the order. It just kind of worked out that way. And they crunched the numbers. And yes, in fact, in a 30 pitch span, George Kirby threw 26 strikes. Now that's Kirby, and we can always kind of put him on the pedestal because he is kind of a freak in that regard. But what stands out to me the most is you just have a wide collection of strike throwers. So my question to you, Jerry, is how much of this do you think has the org taught throwing strikes, which seems like a basic thing but is much harder than it sounds like? And then how much of it is of the equation is you guys have just gravitated to those who naturally have this skill set?
I think it's the latter of those two. You know, I wish we could say we're magical in our ability to teach strike throwing. I think we do better than many in that category, you know, and there are some guys that came into our system with a skill set that wasn't quite like it is now, you know, and I'm going to use examples. Some of them are, you know, Luis Castillo has had the best three-year run of strike throwing that he's had in his career. You know, right now, I think he's rocking 11 punchouts per nine and sub two walks per nine. That's elite. You know, it's the six to one strikeout to walk ratio just doesn't really happen in the game, and our guys do that kind of routinely, and George does it as a hobby. You know, it's just something he does naturally. George has always been a strike thrower. Logan has always been a strike thrower. You know, Brian Wu, we just didn't know. You know, there wasn't enough data to lead you in one direction or another, but all his operation suggested that he was going to be a strike thrower. Bryce got better in our system. And, you know, I would also say that it's almost an association. When you watch George do George and you watch Logan do Logan, you know, and you are the guy that follows, you're probably going to do your best to emulate it because you watched it, you know, and I could really flash back, and, you know, we talk a lot in this circle. We talk a lot about the fascination that I have with what the Braves were doing in the 90s. Similarly, you know, if you were going to pitch in that rotation, you had to, you know, you had to keep up with the Joneses, and that's what our Joneses do. They hammer the strike zone.
When I think about this conversation, like Gabe Spire comes to my mind immediately because we've had this conversation with Gabe. It's changed his career.
Yep.
He's been completely different with the Mariners. I think he's been enormous for your bullpen so far this season, especially no Brash, no Santos. What have you seen from Gabe Spire this year?
It's probably just an extension of what we saw last year. He gets ahead. He gets ahead. He doesn't let you get in hitters counts. And, you know, right now I think Gabe is still working into his stuff. You know, it's early in the year. And like we saw last year, by midseason, he started humming into like mid upper 90s occasionally with the fastball. And spring training this year to where he is today, like he was a year ago, it's more 92, 95. He might hit one occasionally higher. And then I think when the summer starts to heat up, you'll see the real stuff. And I don't know how much better he can be. You know, he's arguably been as valuable as any pitcher we have, and especially in our bullpen right now. And the bullpen's been generally awesome. And, you know, Gabe just hammers the strike zone. And you know, I will say, while I don't think we can't take a ton of credit for teaching awesome starting pitchers how to throw strikes, you know, we have messaged very clearly, especially in with our bullpen guys, this is how we do it. And, you know, it has been a pretty smooth transition for a lot of guys who weren't historically great strike throwers, who wind up going on great runs with us in terms of hammering the strike zone. And I think you see the benefits of it with Gabe Spier. You know, he can sink it. He fills it up with his fastball. He's got a quick little slider, and he's not afraid of contact. And, you know, the way you're going to dominate the strike zone is to not be afraid of contact. It's getting in there. You're going to get a lot of foul balls. You're going to find yourself in 1-2 count a lot of the time. And as a pitcher in this league, when you've got the kind of stuff that Gabe has, when you're 1-2, it's really hard to find success for a hitter.
It really sounds like, especially when we talk about the bullpen and some of the guys who didn't have it and now they do it at an elite level, it's really more like a mindset than anything else, right? Like Gabe didn't suddenly put on a Mariners uniform and discover how to throw strikes, but he just wasn't afraid of being over the plate as much. Is that a fair way to look at it?
Well, I just think from organization to organization, the teaching or the message points are just different, you know. And when pitchers come here, our people, you know, Trent and Woody, our pitching strategists, our minor league coaches, our analysts are all in tune with what a pitcher needs to do to improve. And the first thing, after we tell them, we throw strike one, and we win the 1-1s. It's those two simple messaging points. And then we walk them through, and I know you've heard this reference or maybe talked to some of our players about it. We sit down and we walk them through where their green clouds are. You know, this is where this pitch needs to be, you know, and this is where you are right now. And the visual of seeing, you know, a bigger piece of the strike zone that's covered by a green cloud, it gives you the confidence to know if I'm in this zone, I'm going to be great. And I think that's the comfort point for the pitchers. We're not asking them to throw it into a teacup. And sometimes even for minor league coaches, you can winnow it down to, you need to get that down. It needs to be away. And then all of a sudden, you've got guys with awesome stuff who are nibbling around the plate. You don't need to nibble when you've got the kind of stuff that these guys have. You just need to get over I don't want to say the heart of it. You just need to get over the white of it and just start hammering away. And then once you get in those 1-2 counts, those, you know, 1-2-0-2 type counts, you know, now you can start carving it up and dissecting. You know, and when you have the kind of command that, say, George Kirby has, it's just keep on doing what you're doing. You'll never see another command outing as good as that one. It was a shame that we sprinkled a walk in there, because otherwise it was about as perfect could possibly be.
Oh, if it wasn't for Walker himself in that start, gobbling up 12 pitches.
In that series.
Yeah, that was an amazing – it was an amazing at bat, like that battle between – Kirby and Walker, but Kirby, man, got a distance without that one.
Yep. I know you guys remember Paul Davis, who was our pitching coach here for a couple of years, and PD he had nicknames for every, you know, quirky thing. You know, the Maddox was the, you know, the 100 pitcher less, you know, complete game. He called the three pitch, you know, attack strikeout, the Cliffy. You know, there was another one that he had was called the Priester, and you know, they were all named after pitchers who did these things frequently. And I think if any pitcher who throws 25 strikes and 30 pitches, we'll call it the Kirby.
The Kirby.
I like it. Yeah.
Kirby was
it can't just be the Kirby. It has to end in stir.
Yeah, that makes sense. Kirby almost had an immaculate inning in the first inning.
Yes.
He threw one ball to McCarthy and one ball to Marte. Otherwise, he would have punched out the side in order on touching 99 multiple times. Like that, I thought that was the most – this is a ridiculous thing to say. Gary and I talked about this, I think, at one point. Like, I think that was the most single dominant inning we've seen by a Mariner pitcher this year.
Oh, I'll agree with
that. Okay. I mean, just like the pure swing and miss stuff on a heater, just middle. And like good big league hitters who have hardware can't sniff it. Like, pretty remarkable.
You know, this was very – it was very major league. You know, like, I think we're going to go with the heater.
I called it the Lou Brown inning.
Yeah, we were talking about it up here in the box. Like, hey, don't overthink this one. Give him the heater.
Yes.
Thank you for the Paul Davis imagery, by the way. I always think of his headshot when someone says his name, which was just very – what are you thinking about right now, Paul? What's going on right there? Hey, just a generic – pitching question for you. Like, I've seen Mariner pitchers do this. I've seen opposing pitchers do this, not just this year, but since the dawn of time. You get ahead of a guy 0-2, right? And so what are you thinking? Like, don't throw him anything over the plate. Let's see if he'll chase something. But then the third pitch is just like a mile away from anything, right? Like, it is a waste pitch. Like, it's, you're not doing yourself any favor. Like, what's the – I understand the thought process there. Is that just simply just bad execution by the pitcher if that happens?
I think so. And, you know, it's a – I don't – our pitchers – and George is a great example of it, don't really miss big. And, you know, one of the things we do with our shove report when we're going through our scoring, you know, is there's a penalty to be paid for big misses, you know. Big misses are a negative. And, you know, and I guess if you want to miss small, because what you're trying to do is expand the hitter's vision. You're trying to expand, you know, his – I guess you want him to go fishing, so to speak. But in order to get him to go fishing with very few hitters, and there are a couple of exceptions in our league, you know, you can't really throw it in the other batter's box and get, you know, big swings. So you want it to look like a strike for long enough to get him to go with you. And I think the big miss, especially in the era of velocity, you know, the big miss is just a misfire. It's what it is. It's a mistake. I don't think they're intending to miss that big. And they're certainly not, you know, Ryan Duren who are throwing stuff off the backstop. It is it they're it's just a mistake. I think when they don't want to miss just off the edge, but you want to make it look like a strike for as long as you can before it gets under, away from, or over the zone. And our guys, you maybe more 0-2 and 1-2 pitches from this group of starting pitchers, especially, you know, and Gabe Spire is another one where they just get right after you. You know, if you just keep coming. And it, Emerson Hancock is a great example. You know, the speed with which he's working right now, is it's his friend. He's filling up the strike zone, and he's just keeping the pressure on the hitter. And, you know, he doesn't have the kind of physical stuff that some of the guys have. And but he's got good location right now. He's executing good deception. And he's using the speed of the game as his friend. And he's taking good stuff and turning it into great stuff as a result.
Is there something with his arm, something that makes him hard to pick up?
It's like it's right now. It's like it's coming out of his shirt. You know, it is how it appears to me. He's got kind of a shorter stroke, and there's almost like a push out of his body, his torso, and it's hard to see. And, you know, but I guess if you get enough looks at anything, you're going to pick up where it comes from. This goes back to our, and I think we've talked about this in years past. It takes the hitter some time to clear what he just watched. You know. And it's not a second or two. It's like 12 or 15 seconds that are required for the hitter to take a breath and just flush out the pitch he just saw and refocused. Now, so in theory, if you just keep on coming, the hitter really hasn't had a chance to refocus, you know. And now if you're good enough at tunneling your pitches, you know, you can make one pitch look like the last and look like the one before it with subtle movements. And then, you know, those pitch overlays that you see from, you know, like Pitching Ninja or something like that, you know, that becomes devastating. Small, subtle movements that create, you know, the look of the ball going one turns left, one turns right, one dips down, one rides. If you're doing that and you're doing it quickly, the hitter can't adapt. And, you know, it's why some of the guys that we've talked about over the years, like a Kirk Reeder, stands out. Really didn't have great stuff, you know. Just filled up the strike zone and worked at a lightning speed. Mark Burley's out there throwing 85 and at the tail end of his career, and he's just working so fast that you never get a chance to square him up because you can't clear out what happened before.
You mentioned evaluating big misses differently. Do you evaluate strikes differently? Because not every strike is equal, right? Like, sometimes I think we undersell George Kirby by just saying he's a great strike thrower when he's paint, right? And that's different than just throwing it over the middle of the plate. So are strikes within the strike zone evaluated differently?
Yes, and we actually call them cookies. You know, so if it's too much plate, you know, it's a cookie, and a cookie is going to be, you know, it's going to get dinged. But we still want to recognize the value of being over the plate.
Okay.
But I think you're 100% right. And we once had a trade inquiry on George Kirby where we were at a winter meetings and we're sitting down with another club and their manager. happened to be in the room, and we were interested in one of their offensive players, and they talked about the potential of matching up on Kirby, you know, and we wouldn't discuss Kirby in this context or any, you know, he's not available. And the manager said, I really like the strike throwing. And I said, yeah, there's a lot to like there.
Hey, offensively for your ball club, Josh Rojas has really been a big piece to what the Mariners have done this year. We know about his work defensively at third base. But with him taking over the leadoff spot in the absence of J.P. Crawford, the Rojas Revenge Tour was a real thing against Arizona. I don't know how many more leadoff home runs we'll see. Maybe we will. But I feel like there's more to that than just playing a team over the weekend at T-Mobile Park. But he's really shown his best, biggest spark to date as a Mariner in this recent run.
Oh, without a doubt. And I think it started really right after spring training. You know, and just weird how baseball works. Of all of our offensive players, 13 hitters that made our club, 11 of them had not just good springs, but awesome springs. Josh wasn't one of those, 11. And from day one to now, he is having an awesome start to his season. And, you know, his contact quality, his contact frequency, his walk rate is in the range of what his walk rate usually is. His strikeout rate is as low as it's ever been. His barrel rate has been, the best you'll see from Josh Rojas. And, but he's done these things before. And it's important to remember that about players. You know, it's a 3-4 week stretch in a marathon season over the life of a multiple marathon career. Josh has always been a pretty good player. And right now I think you're seeing a good player have a great start to a season. And over the course of the weekend against the Diamondbacks, I thought it was remarkable how he was getting the ball out in front of the plate. And, you can tell when Josh is seeing the ball and has the feeling like he can go ambush one. And, he's not the Julio or the, Nelson Cruz who's probably going to, who's going to hit their 25 or 35 and they're waiting for the ball to travel. Josh has to sense, it's almost like a guess sometimes, what am I going to get here? Is it going to be over the plate? If I see it up, I'm going. And he has been really, a godsend for us in the early season because he's by far been the most consistent offensive producer we've had, and to see him add some power to that mix over this weekend was a lot of fun. And he has real pull side power. We saw it last year in the late summer, and to see what he's done in this early year and how easily he's identifying pitches. And I pinch myself, I hope he can manage this for the next 6 or 7 months, because it'll be good for everybody.
He was a important part of that deal, and yet I think someone who was overlooked maybe by a lot of Mariners fans when that deal went down. Tell us how important he was from your perspective.
Yeah, so important that when we did the deal, we for quite some time, we stood on, we won't do this deal unless Josh Rojas is in the deal. And that held it up, by more than a little bit. And, sometimes that's just posturing on another team's part. But I know the Diamondbacks held his makeup in the clubhouse and leadership skills in a very high regard. And he did not have a good year last year, and they knew he was down, and they had sent him to the minor leagues for a little bit of a reset. But at the end of the day, he had been such a key part of what they were doing the 2 years prior and was so ingrained in their clubhouse that they were hesitant, for very similar reasons to why we might have been hesitant on the other end of it. I could say the same things about Paul. But, ultimately we made the swap. I'm glad they ultimately decided to put him in. And right now we're reaping the benefits of, just betting on a player to return to what he typically does. And he's got such a high baseball IQ. He's awesome on the bases. He's managing the strike zone. And, we talk about WAR productivity ad nauseum sometimes. For the 2 years prior to when he joined the Mariners last year, he's a 2.5 win player, and that's hard to find.
Let's talk strikeouts from an offensive side, which is not as pleasant as from a pitching perspective.
Decidedly less pleasant.
So, I mean, if anybody were to say, sum up the Mariners off season in a multiple sentences, it would be reduce the strikeouts, get on base more often, right? Something along those lines. There have still been a lot of strikeouts so far this season as we're getting near the end of the first full month. What is a realistic projection for where you think the Mariners can be by season's end in terms of a strikeout rate? It's impossible to go from, oh, this team struck out the most in 2023 and they strike out the least in 2024. Like, that's just not realistic. So what is the realistic picture that you would paint?
I guess it might be realistic because once upon a time, I think the Astros did just that.
Yeah, they had. I guess they got rid of Colby Rasmus and the big bopper.
Evan Gattis.
And Carter, was it? They had a few swing and miss guys.
Yeah, going into this offseason, it was a priority for us to find more contact. And, but I think yesterday's game is a great example of it. In the third inning with the bases loaded and nobody out, we want to build a lineup that is not going to run into, nine misses and we're back in the dugout. And, we didn't convert yesterday. Frankly, if we do convert, we sweep that series. But, we didn't do it yesterday and we haven't done it, in the first month of the season like we envisioned. We don't anticipate being the most contact-oriented team in the league. We just want to get closer to average. We were the second worst in the league last year. Somehow we've regressed. We tried to get better and we got worse. But we are right now, we've got a handful of players who don't really have the swing and miss or chasey skill sets or track records who for some reason are running the highest strikeout rates or higher, one of the higher chase rates in their careers. I tend to think that's just players putting pressure on themselves and that over time it will resolve. But we don't anticipate, turning into the Cleveland Guardians overnight. Our expectation was that we could build a longer lineup, more inclined to make contact and less inclined to punch out with men on second and third and one out over and over, which is, part of the reason why we thought we weren't able to convert runs so often last year. And I will say this about our lineup to date, especially for the last 2 weeks, maybe not including yesterday. As a general rule, I think despite the fact that maybe Josh might be the only hitter in our lineup that's just been consistent from day one to now, we've had real contributions up and down the lineup in a timely way that have allowed us for the last couple of weeks to score runs despite the fact that we still haven't really gotten on track offensively. And I think we were without really banging it around at Coors Field, which might have been an easy place to get healthy. And we generally spent 2 weeks scoring five-ish runs a game just by taking our walk, getting on base the way we get on base, and we started to find our power stroke. And, that's the secret.
Yeah, because when I think about your offense, the slug is – we didn't see it in the first part of the season. Yep. And we've seen it more the last couple weeks. How do you think about the relationship? Because I'm someone that I'm less concerned about the strikeout rate if you have the slug. But how do you see the relationship between strikeout rate and slug?
If you're going to strike out, you better slug, And if you slug, you can live with the extra strikeout. And, for us, the neutralizer or the caveat is in all circumstances, you got to be willing to take your walk. Mm-hmm. And we, for the first 2 weeks of the season, we weren't finding our walks very often. And I don't think it was because we weren't in tune or patient. We haven't faced too many back end starters this year, and it's usually where you find your walks. You don't find your walks against Jose Berrios, and you find them against somebody's fifth starter. We weren't really doing that as routinely as we sometimes do. And then we got on a run. And, now you look up and our walk rate is right where it typically is. I think right about that 9.5%-ish or something in that range. Our strikeout rate is just way too high. And again, some of that can be chalked up to the fact that we've seen better pitching than you might expect in this kind of run, a 25-ish game run or however long it's been. But more often, it's just that we're not executing in our at-bats. And if you're going to punch out 29% of the time, you got to slug. Mm-hmm. And, you've got to do your damage in ISO, we'll call it, in advanced stats. And we're not doing that. We've got a number of hitters who are so far off of their norm in terms of slugging. And again, I just think it's guys putting a lot of pressure on themselves and over-adjusting. Because it's not like we're sitting here saying, oh, man, he just missed that one. You know, they're just – they're off. Their timing is off. You know, otherwise they wouldn't be hitting, you know, or looking at offensive production or lack thereof like it is. And at some point it'll click, and then we'll go through a 3 or 4 week run where they're just hot as fire, because that's the way baseball works.
Entering this Braves series, the Mariners are second in baseball right now in pitches seen per plate appearance. And Scott, I brought this up with Scott a little while ago, not that exact number, but the idea of it. And he made it fairly clear that the message is hunt your pitch,
yep.
Right? Whether that's for the first pitch or the eighth pitch of the at-bat. When you look at pitches per plate appearance, I mean, is that something that you sink your teeth into? Is that something that's kind of on the auxiliary of what is at the heart of the Mariners' offensive philosophy? Where does that land for you?
Pretty high. You know, the teams that see pitches, that work the opposing pitcher, they're the teams that score. They're the teams that typically win. You know, the goal is you want to knock the starter out. You want to get into a bullpen. You want to, you know, that's how you drive it. And even in today's era where you're facing big stuff coming out of the bullpen, there's usually big stuff with some type of, you know, caveat attached to it. Lesser command, you know, 1.5 pitches. You can isolate down to, you know, a fastball and a breaking ball instead of having to cover 3 or 4 pitches. You know, there's just less diversity in the bullpen. You know, we want our hitters to see pitches. That being said, if you get the cookie on the first pitch, take a pass. You know, if you get into your 2-1, 3-1 counts, we're not urging our hitters to take and get to 3-1 or ball 4. If you get a pitch in your hot zone, go, you know, and take your pass. That's why you work. That's why you dominate the zone, so that you can get into those hitters' counts. You know, and that has been relayed to our hitters since the moment they put on a Mariners uniform. Whether in the minors or in the big leagues, it's, you know, we are doing what we do so that we can bang. You know, we want to get into those situations and get the pitch in your hot zone and take a pass.
Are you ready for some stump, JD, Jerry?
Never been more ready.
This is a I don't know. This is just going to be a lucky guess kind of a stump, JD.
Oh, God.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what we actually were looking for.
Can we cut that and just save that as a sound effect we use for anything? All right. This was born out of inadvertent research on our part. We noticed that Jorge Polanco has never hit a grand slam.
Wow.
How about that? Huh?
Wow.
The guy's been around for a while.
I did not have that. I didn't know that.
Yeah, we were just – just click on his home run log and scroll around. You'll find it. So Jorge has 115 career home runs, okay? He is now the game's active leader in home runs without a grand slam.
Wow.
He was previously bested by Mariner nemesis Cole Calhoun, who has since retired.
So Cole had no grand slam.
No, he had like 170 homers and change without a grand slam.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah, no wonder he retired, right? Okay, so here's the question. Give me the game's all-time leading home run hitter who never hit a grand slam.
Oh, my God. I was teed up. I wanted to go on the pitching end. It's like Jim Palmer.
Palmer never gave one up.
In his career.
Yeah, he never gave.
Which is phenomenal. All-time home run leader who never hit a grand slam. This has just got to be shooting fish in a barrel.
Can I give you era or teams? Or how about we start with this? I'm going to start with this, okay? He was taken fifth overall, okay, the same year that Bob Melvin was taken second overall in the draft, 1981. He was a two-time All-Star, a Silver Slugger Award winner. He played from 1984 to 1993.
So there's a very brief crossover in my career. 1984 to 1993, the fifth overall selection.
First baseman.
Wow, what a tough one.
Do you want I can give you teams?
No.
I just saw he played 2 years in Japan.
Did he really?
To finish his career. And he hit like 60 bombs over there.
What?
mid-50s.
I did not know that.
And I wonder if he hit a grand slam over there in Japan.
I'm guessing he hit like 8.
like 1 per series.
Yeah. Could it be Glenn Davis?
Oh, Jerry! Jerry!
That is unbelievable. What? No way. No way.
Oh, my goodness. What? How do we do it?
How did we do it?
Well, for the listening public, I just sat here and stared into the abyss for 3
minutes.
I mean,
we are about to miss first pitch.
There was some editing of silence that the listeners
missed. But honestly, not that long
not
in
that
the grand
long.
Scheme
yeah.
of the day.
Yeah. in the grand scheme of our lives, yeah, that wasn't that
pretty,
much time.
Pretty minute.
But there were no. It wasn't 6 misses
how
before.
Did
I
arrive,
how did you,
Glenn Davis?
How did you get that?
Mostly, I was just trying to put together those years. You know, there's a process depending on the era. You know, sometimes I think in terms of you know baseball reference pages. Sometimes I think in terms of scouting. Sometimes I think in terms of teammates, and sometimes I think in terms of the picture that was on baseball cards when I was, you know, a younger version of myself, you know. And
do you think you have an unfair advantage because of your obsession with baseball?
Yes, without a doubt. You know, we were, as we talk about it, it's a like, you know, the Immaculate Grid is I'm obsessed with it. I do it every day. But the, you know, a friend of mine who I share my Immaculate Grid score with said, you know, there has to be some advantage to being, you know, a president of baseball ops, having been a player, having been, you know, a scout for a number of years, you know, it's like a lot of coverage. I said, oh, throw into that, like, and I think you guys know this, I was a AAA clubhouse guy. So for the 1987-88 AAA seasons, like every rando up and down guy sticks out in my head like, you know, I cleaned his shoes.
I had no idea about this. When did this happen for you?
Yeah, when I was in college. So it was the Richmond Braves. You know, we shared a stadium with the Richmond Braves. I went to Virginia Commonwealth University, and Bruce Baldwin, who ran the Braves. When I was a sophomore in college and getting ready to play summer ball, I tore my tricep, and I couldn't go pitch summer ball. And he asked me, he said, you know, we need somebody to take care of our visitors clubhouse. You know, you mind doing it? And I said, no, I'd love to do it. So I had a killer summer job. You know, I made good dough. I lived 3 miles away. You know, our place was 3 miles from the stadium. So I could ride my bike there. And it was, I took care of that. This was during the Braves AAA era of, you know, guys like John Smoltz, and who I wound up playing all my career against. John Smoltz, I think it was Tom Glavine, Ron Gant, Derek Lilliquist, who was a teammate of mine a couple of years later, and it was a blast. And all the guys that came through there was so much fun. And now I'll remember them, like, you know. How do you remember some of these names? And I said, I sat down and had a conversation with them when I was 20 years old about throwing a slider. And they, you know, it's amazing the things that I remember from that time.
See, that's perfect because the actual Atlanta Braves at the time, they were bad.
Yeah.
But they were on the cusp of being great.
Oh, yeah.
So they had guys coming up and down, and that's perfect.
Yeah, it was crazy. And the teams that came through, you know, think about, you know, the that time, like the mid-late 80s, and it was right in the midst of when the American Association, which for a number of years was by itself, you know, they were playing the AAA Alliance. So you got to see, I didn't only get to see the International League's players, I got to saw the American Association's players and all of the up and down. So, you know, baseball cards, baseball, you know, card pictures, collecting as a kid and then later as an adult, you know, was quickly transitioned into, oh, now I just clean their shoes and wash their jocks.
Jerry, this has been fun. Thank you so much.
You got it, guys.
It's blazing hot outside. You get in your car to turn on the AC to get cold air pumping, but it blows hot air out. This issue is commonly caused by low refrigerant due to leaks in the AC system. You want an easy, all-in-one solution that will restore the cold air in no time. AC Pro Recharge Kits make restoring cold air easy for even those with zero DIY experience in less than 10 minutes. Save time and money versus going to a shop by picking up an AC Pro Recharge Kit today. Be a pro with AC Pro.